Hello and a big welcome to Happy Place. I'm Fern Cotton and this is a space for us to gently work through our messy stuff together in real time. Today I'm meeting the lead vocalist and bassist of one of my favourite bands. It's Mike Kerr from Royal Blood.
The songwriting thing was terrifying. Like, hang on a minute, I've only done this certain way. What if it doesn't work? And that was such a massive fear. I felt like I was having to relearn how to do everything. There was a long period of time where I was like, I don't know who I am. Genuine identity loss, because it's like starting from scratch. You have to build yourself up. I didn't know how to just hang out with people or have a conversation without any drinks.
Oh, I cannot wait for you to hear this chat, because Mike is just so open and thoughtful about how he's learning to be in a rock band and be sober at the same time. Touring as a musician isn't a lifestyle that naturally lends itself to sobriety, but he's found some brilliant new ways of releasing all that energy and adrenaline.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Should we do it? Right, here's the show. Mike, are you good?
I'm good. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm really good. I've listened to your album a lot over the last week, but on my morning run today, the single Typhoons got me up a particularly horrific hill. So thank you for that.
You're very welcome. We seem to be popular with gym music for a long time now, I think.
Yeah, it's something about your music that just sort of like it gets the adrenaline going. I feel very powerful listening to your music. That's my thing. I feel like I am sort of Mo Farah on my park run when I'm listening to your music.
See, when I run, it's complete silence.
No way.
Yeah, it's pretty morbid.
And why? What's that about? Do you just need to sort of concentrate on what your body's doing?
I don't know. I think a part of it is particularly like when I'm making an album, I don't want to listen to anything.
Right.
My ears are so tight. I think it's a mixture of that. I don't know. I like listening to my thoughts on the run.
Oh, I don't.
It is quite dark sometimes, isn't it? Like, I realised the other day I was running and I caught myself having an argument with someone who didn't even exist.
Yeah.
About a subject I'd never even... I was like, yeah, well, you would say that. And I was like, what am I doing?
Well, no, what you're doing is you're essentially meditating, aren't you? Because
yeah.
I was having a chat with someone the other day and I think I actually grasped what meditating was from having this conversation, that it's not just getting all the thoughts out your head, it's actually giving yourself the time and space to have a conversation with your ego. So it's where your spiritual side meets your ego. So you're doing that during your runs. That is a good thing to do.
There you go. Yeah, I do get that feeling from it as well, actually. It's, conversations with yourself, yeah.
Maybe I need to do it, because I think I'm looking for sort of the ultimate distraction from my thoughts, but also from the fact that I'm running. Like, I don't want to think about the fact that I'm running. I just want it to be like, this is great music, this is a good podcast. Oh, I'm home.
Yeah.
Because you've got so into running recently, right? I saw you did 48 miles in 48 hours.
Yeah.
For charity. How was that?
It was hard. Yeah, you have to run 4 miles every 4 hours on the dot, and you do it for 48 hours.
Wow.
It's more the psychological element of it. It's designed by this guy, David Goggins, who I'm sure you've heard of.
I haven't, which is awful, but please tell me.
He's this ex-Navy SEAL guy, this American guy, who's like Mr. Hard Man. He's just like, he's like run for like 200 miles and he just does like crazy shit. And he kind of designed this challenge, and it's designed by a psychopath. It's like he's worked out the exact amount of time Because like for the 4 hours between is just perfect to ruin it.
Right.
Because you're so buzzed after the run and you have this adrenaline, then you could, if it was every 2 hours, you could almost go out, but then you start to fade away and then you try and sleep and at that point it's like 40 minutes sleep. And then you're back out again and it's the stopping and starting. Everyone does it around the world at the same time. But if you're in the UK, it started at 4 a.m. So me and a couple of mates did it and we were down the pier at 4 a.m. And it's when we got the second day around. Well, it was like, we have to do that all again.
No, I don't. I'm questioning why you did this. Well, obviously for charity, which is wonderful. And what? Where are you sleeping when you have those breaks?
Just coming home.
Oh, you go back home and then you're back out again.
Yeah, I would like shower every single time and then like put my running stuff by the bed and then... But the sleeps would get like deeper and deeper as it went on. So it would be like waking up from a coma. You'd just be like that, just that like white panic of like,
oh, like, oh my God. And then so what was going on in your head during, because that's a long time to have a conversation with yourself. What was coming up for you then?
I was with other people. So we were able to kind of keep each other sane. Distractions helpful with those kind of things.
Yeah.
I'm no athlete, but that's one thing I've noticed. When things are when you feel the kind of energy of everyone is gone, someone needs to crack a joke, yeah. Someone needs to do something. I remember on the second to last run, this guy we were with, he was, you could tell he had just checked out. He was getting ready to give up and he was just, you know, he'd just gone really quiet for ages. And then he stopped for a sec, started walking. We were like, no, come on. We got him going again. And I just started reeling off facts about the Titanic because I went down this like Titanic hole where I got really obsessed with the Titanic. And I started reeling off these like mad facts about it. And we got to the end of the run and he was like, you have no idea what those Titanic facts did.
What a
he was
great
like,
tactic.
I just needed to take my mind away for a second so my body could kind of get through it.
One of my friends has a similar technique for when she can't sleep, and she runs through, she starts at our queen now, Queen Elizabeth II, and she just keeps going back in the line of monarchy and just to see how far she can go. And then usually she's asleep by Henry VIII or whatever. Great. Such a good
Amazing.
One. So look, you've had such a game-changing few years. Am I right, Mike? Are you 30 at the moment?
I am.
You're 30, right. So what I was sort of thinking when I was writing up this episode was, this is probably all part of your Saturn returns. Do you know, have you heard of Saturn returns?
No, not really.
Okay, so your Saturn returns is between the ages of about sort of 27 and 31. And essentially it's, you know, how many years it takes for Saturn to get back to the point it was at when you were born. And supposedly during that period of 27 to 30, 31... transformational stuff's happening. My God, in my own life, it was absolutely the case in, you know, horrendous ways at times. And I think of like I'm sort of just healing from all of that now. But it's often where game-changing, life-changing stuff happens. And it seems from the outside like that's what you've been experiencing. I mean, so much change in your life. First of all, your music has, you know, you wanted to approach that differently and get a different sound and work in a new way, right?
Yeah, I think the music we've made is a total reflection of where I'm at. And yeah, you can hear the energy on the second record compared to this one. And I think the reason they're not unrecognisable, but you can tell that something's changed. It's not just it wasn't a sort of premeditated or artistic decision to do something different. It's more of a reflection of how I've changed as a person. But it's funny you say it about it being like a return journey, because the album that we've made, to my friends who know me and have known me for years, they think it sounds like the band I was first in when I was like 15 and 16.
Yeah.
And they're saying this is the most like Mike Kerr, Ben Thatcher thing I've ever heard.
Wow.
Because when Royal Blood came out, they were kind of like, not confused, but they were like, Mike doesn't really play bass. We've never really heard them do like rock music like this. So there's like a sonic return on this album, but I've got a theory, which I think a few people would share, which is that when you start drinking or taking drugs, when the moment that begins, no matter how innocent it is, I always have this theory that you begin to abandon that person slowly. I think as my drinking went on and on and on and went and got harder and harder and harder to sobriety, yeah, I almost feel like I returned back to that person and sort of picked up where I left off.
Mm.
And it's really weird. Like, there's even like hobbies and things that I did when I was really young. Like, I used to like be obsessed, I was like a proper nerd, like obsessed with like card tricks and things like that. And I'm like, why did I stop doing that? And I used to kite surf as well. So recently I was like, I'm getting back into kite surfing. And just sort of, yeah, picking up all these parts of me that I just abandoned and left. So yeah, the return journey thing makes complete sense. And I feel like I've done that. And yeah, the album is, it sounds like the first band I was in.
But that's so cool. And you've done it, you know, not being patronising in the slightest, but you've done it at a young age, like 30, to have sorted that out and to come back to yourself is amazing. I'm 40 this year and I feel like I'm just doing it now. I think I got stuck in that bit. And I think that can often happen. Like, you get stuck in the bit where you've abandoned bits of yourself or you're just not quite able to like push through it. And I feel exactly the same as where you're at. But now, later down the line, that I'm definitely, again, like taking interest again in all the things that I loved as a kid, like really simple stuff, just like, you know, it's so obvious and almost sounds cliched, but just being outside, you know, looking at the stars or, you know, just looking at the sky or going for a walk in the park and all the stuff that you, you know, inherently as a kid draw from. I feel like I'm doing that again, and it's really lovely, and I feel very grateful that I'm getting back to that place at the moment. It's a really good feeling, and I know how hard it is when you do get stuck. So how long was your drinking a problem? That sort of that moment of being stuck in the abandonment. I so understand that.
It's sort of something that crept up on me, and it's hard for me to define the particular moment. I feel like the frog in the water that slowly, the temperature slowly getting in hotter. I couldn't sort of detect, yeah, when things are problematic. I mean, it's the temperature was getting raised on it around the second album. I'd been on tour for like 3 years and every day was, as fun as it was like a stag do, like every day.
Mm.
And I started taking check on myself thinking, have I really been drunk every day for 2 years? I was like, wow, that's mental. And not just like, oh, a few too many, like obliterated.
Yeah.
And playing shows and traveling and interviewing and on this journey and experiencing something cosmic and it just being this, every day we were doing something mind-blowing. We were meeting someone we'd never dream we'd get to meet or play with bands that, it was so beyond anything we expected. So just an incredibly intense experience. And it got to the second record and it was like that had become normal. That was like the baseline. And yeah, we were known for that. And it's funny, the way I normalized it, and I think human beings are amazing at just normalizing craziness. We evolve so quickly to whatever's going on around us. And yeah, I just normalised it. But yeah, the way I kind of normalised it was that I thought I was functioning. And the way I determined that was whether I could do a show or not.
Right.
And that was it, which is mental. It's mental. Like, our studio up the road, there's a pizza restaurant next to it. And I always go and have a coffee with the chefs in there. And I was talking to one of the pizza chefs and we were talking about the exact same thing. And she's got the dough machine going, right, with the dough whizzing around. And we're talking about this idea of functioning. And I was like, if that machine was like sparking at the plugs, smoke was billowing out of it, it was like rattling over the floor, and it just about made one batch of dough, I was like, we wouldn't say it was functioning. It's like falling apart. That's kind of how I was like that dough machine, you know. I was just like falling apart. But as long as I could get away with it, everything was fine.
Mm, and also you lose the sense of, you know, functioning might be fine, but what about thriving? You know, what about thriving? Where's that option? Is that option available? And that seems to be, well, most definitely with this record, that's the only way that I can sort of pick up on that. And from the bits that I've read about you, but it seems like a time now of thriving. And I guess to do so, you have to have acceptance of yourself. You have to feel pretty happy in your own skin. Obviously, previously, before, I'm imagining that some of that drinking into oblivion was, as you said, trying to abandon parts of yourself and a lack of that self-acceptance. Have you sort of worked out why you were trying to run from yourself?
It's something I'm unravelling at the minute, and it's really interesting. There's loads of theories on it. What one is that, you know, I was always kind of destined to fall into trouble with drugs and alcohol, and it's something I was born with. But I heard something recently, which is like, you have to look at what alcohol and drugs sort of did for you. Like, what was the positives, and what did they bring to the table? And for me, I'm trying to identify like what particular traumas have happened in my life that I was sort of medicating for. So it doesn't seem to have one answer for me at the minute. All I know is that my job and my experience of being in the band just allowed me to live like that without really being questioned. I think if I had nearly any other job, someone would have been like, what are you doing?
Yeah, you need help. Well, this is it. You know, I read in another article that you'd done an interview in saying that sort of outrageous in plain sight behaviour is almost a cry for help in itself. Did were you sort of aware of that while you're doing it? Like that you were going, hey guys, it looks like I'm having fun, but also help, please help.
Totally, yeah. And I think, in all honesty, I was almost waiting for someone to be like, what are you doing?
And did they?
Not for a long, long time. And I was amazed how far I could go and how publicly and how open I could be about what I was doing without someone going, that's a bit much, isn't it? Can we have, we should have a word. Like, no, it's, there's, you have to go far. And it's funny, I noticed it with a friend of mine a couple of years ago, and I was like, he's doing what I was doing. Mm. He's sort of acting out and he's not all right. And I spoke to him, and turns out he was in a state, and he's now sober and has been sober for a year.
That's amazing.
What's scary is you don't know what someone's going through. Everyone's so good at hiding it, and all I had to do was just pull on this thread and this whole thing just unraveled, and it was, his whole thing was just like, help, you know. And the same thing happened to me. Someone intervened and said, I'm really worried about you, a lot of other people are worried about you, is everything okay? And suddenly it all just came out. I was like, no, actually, I'm not. And this needs to stop. Yeah, it's scary. But you know what? When I spoke to my friend to see if he was all right, maybe it's like an English thing as well. I was so... My biggest anxiety was that I'd got it completely wrong and I was going to embarrass myself.
Yeah.
My biggest thing was that I was going to be like... And him be like, Mike, I think you've got this totally wrong. I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not a... You know, that was my fear. I was more scared of embarrassing myself.
It's often why we don't reach out, isn't it? In any circumstance, if someone's just feeling a bit low or whatever, that we don't want to get it wrong. But I think it's so worth taking the risk to reach out to someone. And it puts you in a vulnerable position reaching out. And that's why we often don't. But it is so... It's so worth it. And I don't know if I want to generalise or not here, but I do think it's probably harder for men to go, I need help. So actually the intervention is really key.
I think it generally is harder for men. Maybe it's because it's more attractive to men to do it on their own.
Yeah. They've got to tough it out. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like something people say to make men reach out, but it really is true that it really does require strength to ask for help.
Hugely.
And when I used to hear that, I used to be like, you're just saying that to make guys feel better. But it really is true. Like, that's why no one does it.
Exactly.
It takes,
and it goes for everyone. You know, it's not a fun thing to admit that you need help and it's also choosing the right person to talk to, because you need it to be the right person that is going to genuinely want to help, rather than, you know, you could easily have people around you going, nah, come on, you're fine, because they want to join in the fun, the debauchery, the decadence of it all. So I think it's key that you find the right people.
Ready to pop the question?
The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And so what, you've been sober now 2 years, is it?
2 years, yeah.
And so how was that creative and recording process, I'm imagining, for the first time with total clarity? You know, how did that change for better or worse when you were recording this last album?
It took a while to get my mojo back and to get to prove to myself that I could do it, because lots of people were telling me that, or at least scaring me, like, what if you need it?
You know, that's nice of them.
I know, yeah. And there's also, it was also a fear in the back of my head. Mm. Like, what if, hang on a minute, I've only done this certain way. This is the recipe. What if it doesn't work? And that was such a massive fear. And it wasn't like I got sober and then the next day I wrote Wonderwall. It was like... I felt like I was having to relearn how to do everything. Mm. There was a long period of time where I was like, I don't know who I am. Mm. I was like, genuine identity loss, because, it's like starting from scratch. So you have to build yourself up. I didn't know how to just hang out with people or have a conversation without any drinks, you know. The songwriting thing was terrifying. And I was just writing some songs. I was like, this sounds like a sober song. It sounds like someone sober. It was like really square and like ordinary. Had no like edges to it. It was like a fucking pebble.
A big old sober pebble.
Yeah. But it took about 8 months. And then suddenly I wrote Limbo. And it was just mental. I was like, where on earth did this come from? And it didn't sound, it was so far away from anything I'd done before. And it was so, it broken every rule in our band and was just so adventurous. And then I sent it to my manager and he was like, that's really, really good. You just write that. I was like, yeah. Just like last week. He's like, great, do another one. Then I wrote Typhoons. And I was just like,
oh my God, that's my favourite song on the album. I love it.
And it was like seeing in colour for the first time. I just had this clarity. And I had so much to say as well. In all honesty as well, I didn't know what to sing about, didn't know what to write about. And then I realised that I had a lot to talk about from where I'd just been. But because I was in this kind of really amazing headspace for the first time, where I felt awake and it felt like I was firing on all cylinders, the music was so like upbeat and euphoric and feel good. And then underneath it all was just this really dark lyrical content about, you know, the sludge that I'd just come out of.
And what about, you know, the rest of it? Because of course there's that element, there's the creativity, there's the recording, there's the writing and mining that well of stuff you've got within you. But there's... obviously to come touring. I know you've done a bit of a tour sober, right? And you played Reading and Leeds sober. I mean, how was that? You know, that's again a very exposing environment. I remember my husband going through the same. He's been sober coming up for 8 years, and the first time he had to do a gig, he was absolutely shitting himself, because he's quite a shy person anyway, and it's an exposing environment, and there you are in front of thousands of people, and you've got to do what you normally do without that chaos and that decadence. What did that feel like?
It was scary. And again, lots of people were going to me, how are you going to do this?
Yeah.
How it was almost them projecting their fears on me. It was like, and looking back, I was like, that's such a mental thing to say to me. And I've just been reading Ross Edgeley's book, you know, that guy that swam around the UK. Mm. I was like, people have done much more, like, extraordinary things with their life. I was like, I'm just going to go and play, like, 20 shows without drinking or taking drugs. It's not. It was, I didn't tell, and no one knew I was sober at this point. And we only had a couple of songs written and recorded. And the whole idea of going out was I needed to remind myself of what I do and who I am. because I was writing songs and I was like, I don't know what we do. I feel so detached now. I'm sober. So the Reading and Leeds opportunity came up and it was like perfect. I was like, because if I can do that, then I can prove to myself that this is a good plan. And it was funny. It really is terrifying. But what I noticed was any technical issues or anything that was slightly off with the crowd, or if there was moments where I thought, instead of just turning around and like necking like loads of tequila out the bottle, I was like, oh, that's not there anymore. It was like my toy had been taken away from me, and I had to navigate through the problem or around it. And then into the next song, I was like, oh my goodness, that was so easy. I was like, what? And then I was just like, what was I doing? That was my solution.
And have you put any sort of coping mechanisms in place going forward? Because, you know, it's not just the getting on the stage. There's the whole caboodle that comes along with being in a band and touring, and obviously great fun and a privilege a lot of the time, but also, you know, hectic. It's not regular. It's not normal. You pack in a lot in a day. You could be in different countries in the same day and meeting multiple strangers in the same day and always sort of aiming for this, imagining your sort of marker of what is perfect or what is right for you as a band. It's an intense environment to be in. So instead of there being that crutch of having alcohol around, have you thought about what might take its place?
Yeah. I think on that last tour, there was things that I set up. I bought a flight case just full of gym equipment, and I would train, sort of do a 40 minute like hit session every show day, and it would roll into the venue while all the crew was setting up all the lights, and I'd just be like the psychopath in the corner just doing press ups and burpees. And so I did that, and then one thing I noticed is that there's such an adrenaline rush coming off stage, and I always found it very difficult to come back down again.
Yeah, you're re-entering the atmosphere.
Yeah, horrible. A horrible, horrible experience. Really, it's its own sort of come down. And it always made me feel something. I don't know, I can't describe it. Something about it was triggering for me.
Well, again, it's not natural,
coming down from a high.
It's not a natural transition to make in everyday life that you know, in a matter of seconds, you're going from thousands of people screaming at you and you're feeding off of it to then literally nothing.
Yeah, silence.
Silence.
So what I realise is that I always wanted that. You want to sustain that level of thing for at least for a bit and release it on your terms rather than get off.
Yeah.
So what I did is I would set up a boxing bag in my dressing room, and sometimes if we're in England, I'd have my trainer come along, and I'd just literally go straight into like a hour boxing session, because there's all this testosterone and masculine energy coming off stage. And I was like, I need to do something with it. And I can't just attack tequila.
Yeah, or Ben.
I need to like fight.
Yeah.
And not hurt anyone. I'm still working it out. But I think in terms of the future and touring, I just have to protect myself from people, places and things. And I can't go out after the show to a bar. Like I really thought about this. When I first got sober, I used to go and do that. I used to be like, well, just because I'm sober doesn't mean I'm going to be boring. I'm still going to come out, guys. Don't worry. And I'd order a tonic and I'd just hang out with people getting drunk. And I was like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
Like this, the whole point of being in a bar is to get drunk.
Yeah.
At least in my opinion, it doesn't make, if you sort of don't drink, sitting in a bar doesn't make much sense.
No.
It's just a room to take drugs in.
But also you're not in that group really, because you're on a totally different level of energy and thought, and you're outside of it.
Yeah, so I have to change everything in order to hold on to sobriety. That's basically it. And it's funny, on that last little tour, I was like, oh my goodness, I'm like up in the morning, and then I'd be like, I've got like 4 hours to do something, and I'd be like, well, I'm in Moscow, so I guess I'm just going to go outside and check it out.
Yeah, why not?
And, then I just had this like thought of like, I felt very guilty to honest with you, because I was like, I've been to all these amazing places, but I haven't been to any of these places. I haven't seen any of it. Mm. And I being the person in my family is probably going there for like the first time, I was like, surely I have some kind of a responsibility to report back when someone goes, what's the Ukraine like? And I'm like,
Yeah, I was hungover. I have no clue.
Where?
No, and that's a lovely thing to explore that time and that freedom. It's amazing.
Yeah. And running, like getting up from the hotel and running and just running around Moscow or running around this place, these new places. I was just like, this is amazing. This is like the best job in the world. Like, yeah. So I think the way I live on tour will just have to change. The idea I can keep the same lifestyle but just remove alcohol is, I think that's a bit of a fairy tale, and it's also really dangerous.
Well, it's also a lot of pressure on you that you probably don't want to be having to deal with, you know. They're changes that I guess from the outside again seem to you to be very intuitive and something that feels right, and that's all we can do is go with that, right?
Yeah, totally.
Another of my favourite songs on the album is Boilermaker. My 8-year-old is obsessed with it and plays it relentlessly on our little home device that you activate by shouting out Boilermaker really loudly. What an amazing song. And this is the song that was produced by another of my favourite musicians ever, Josh Homme, who, again, from the outside, from what I've seen on Instagram, seems to look like he's going through some sort of spiritual awakening or big life turnaround in some way. So how did that help? What was that dynamic like between you?
Yeah, I feel like when we recorded that song, I was at my worst. And I think you can kind of hear it in the song. I was just like falling apart. And that song as well is about being in the bar till 5 a.m. drinking Boilermakers, you know, which is, it's just the idea of just, yeah, whiskey and beer, literally anything. I don't care. Just like, get me out of here. and the kind of, just about all the gross things you might say and the people you're hanging out with. And it's just that, like, the whole song is just kind of gross. that's kind of the setting. It's supposed to make you be like, ugh. And I felt like I was reporting from the front line in that song. And in that studio session, you know, Josh is a hero of mine and such a huge influence on what I do. And the first time I heard Queen of the Stone Age, I stopped the car. I remember someone lent me Songs to the Deaf, and you know, I was brought up a Christian, so everything just sounded like U2, but not even a terrible version of U2. It was all very bland and plain, and everything was. And then I listened to Songs to the Deaf, and it was like, yeah. I literally just pulled the car. It was like, it blew my mind. You know, and it was like, I want to be in that club. So to be working with Josh was just like such a full circle moment. And, you know, I want to impress him. I want to make him proud of what I'm coming up with. But what I realize is that I'm falling apart and suddenly I'm in this amazing moment, but I don't have my shit together. And luckily we had that song Boilermaker, and Josh was brilliant about handling that song, and he really helped us see it through. But I came out of that session like, I need this, something has to change.
So you were still drinking at this point, or you were newly sober?
I was still drinking. I got sober. We were working together for about 2 weeks, and in between the session I went to Vegas to go on a date.
Wow.
And everyone was like, what are you doing? Like, just chill, we've been going to cry. And I was like, everyone was like, please don't go to Vegas. And I was like, bye. I went off to Vegas, and I met this girl, and we had some drinks, and I was just like Ron Burgundy at the bar, just like talking just fucking shit. And this, I had this monologue going that just would always start to happen, where I was like, well, I've got to stop doing this. This can't go on like this. And this poor girl sitting there like, what have I done? I could see immediate regret in her eyes. And I was like, you know, it was like suddenly, and a lot of people share this experience, it was, I don't believe in God, but it was like a light, was something shone upon me And I was almost like sober for a second. And it was like watching the dials of the safe, and it was like the last one just turned around and I could just see through into the other side. And it was so clear. I was like, this is so obvious what I have to do. It's so, so obvious. And I was just at the bar and I was like, this is it, I'm done. She's like, what do you mean? I was like, I'm done. I'm going to stop. I've got to be sober. She's like, really? That's great. Good for you. And so and the barman gave me an espresso martini, which I'd forgotten that I ordered. And I was like, well, that's the last drink then, isn't it? So I just necked it. And
wow.
I was like, thank you and good night.
Wow. And that was your last drink?
Yeah. And that's my girlfriend. We're still together.
Oh, my God. What a bloody great story.
Yeah.
What a moment. I mean, I think, you know, like you just said there, lots of people will have had that experience where it's almost a surrender. It's not because of one particular circumstance or you pushed it too far that time. It's just this little nugget of clarity where you go, mm-hmm. Oh, I think I get it. And it can go for anything in life, not obviously sobriety and other things that are, you know, habitual detrimental behaviours or just thought patterns where you just go, enough's enough. Enough's enough. And
yeah.
And it's so brilliant that you stuck to it. So then you went back to Josh newly sober to finish the song.
Yeah. Yeah, I went back there and we were in the studio and it got to about, I don't know, 5 o'clock, which is when we usually have set up some shots and get the party going. And yeah, Ben and Josh were like handing the shots, here you go, come on, let's have a shot. And then I was like, actually, you know, I've decided I'm just not gonna drink. And everyone was like, oh, cool. And then just carried on. I was like, that was easy.
I thought no big dramatic moment, just okay.
No. And then I remember it came around again. Josh was like, you sure you don't want to drink? And I was like, no. And he was like, so what's going on? Are you just stopping for a bit? And I was like, he's like taking a break. I was like, yeah, yeah. And he was like, that's amazing, man. Good for you. And he said to me, what we're doing in here is so much more important than what's going on out there. And I was like, oh yeah, this is why we're here. I'm not known for getting drunk. I'm known for making music, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But part of me was like, am I just in denial about this? Is this just this, is this going to wear off, you know? But it really didn't. I noticed everything. I noticed my body changing and it's the thoughts that I started to have. It's insane. You just have these thoughts that come into your mind. And you're like, where on earth did that come from? These like things suddenly become really grateful for, or just simple lessons to yourself. It's such an incredible experience. It's the best experience I've ever had in my life getting sober.
Wow.
And I made it in a rock and roll band.
That is just so...
I've had a pretty good life so far.
It's so incredible to hear. I'm so unbelievably chuffed for you and... the fact that the proof's in the pudding with the album, you know, you can absolutely hear it. And I'm interested to hear more about this sort of, you know, you obviously had from quite a young age this pull towards something that was very different to what you'd been brought up with in a very religious household, as you just mentioned. Were you drawn to sort of rock music and that rock and roll sort of vibe because you actively wanted to rebel? Was that something that you sort of instinctively felt?
Yeah, I think it was... Rock and roll was like a response to the way I was brought up, I think. You know, I felt incredibly controlled and mentally abused by my religious upbringing and the churches that I were in. And the mixture of the music being very square, and there was never a place to kind of question anything. And if you did, it was like your bad news. And it was very manipulative, and some of the things we were taught, you know, really messed me up anyway. You know, we taught about hell and the crucifixion, and it was so gory and graphic. And they introduced ideas of like thought crime, you know, saying, you know, there's actions, we're judged on them. But Jesus comes along and he now says that he's up the game. And now if you think something, you're punishable for your thoughts, which is just, that's just mental abuse. That's what I think. I think if you teach someone that they're accountable for their thoughts, that's just abuse.
We have too many thoughts for that to even be brought into the equation. We're not in control in that sense.
Yeah, I did one of Sam Harris's meditation things of the day, and he just said, "You are not the thinker," and I was like, thank you.
Relief. Is that a conversation you can have with your family now?
Yeah, we're all out of it.
And your parents?
Yeah, everyone.
Wow.
And we all just sit around and laugh about it in a really dark way.
Well, that's good. Because that's not always the case. That's really good.
No. So I think, when I found, rock music, it was just so rebellious and it sounded... I almost think going to church and listening to that kind of music could be in that environment. It was just revving up the engine, you know? And being in a band and going on the road, it's particularly at that age, it feels lawless, you know?
Yeah. Maybe you've got this sort of rebellious streak that's always going to be around, because you're almost rebelling against rock and roll now by doing a hit session instead of drinking tequila. I like it.
I guess so, yeah. Yeah. Fighting against the norm, maybe.
Yeah, because, rebellion, the word rebellion often has negative connotations, but I think it's a fantastic word because, well, like you just said, it is essentially just going against the grain, isn't it? Pushing boundaries, it can be in a really healthy, positive way. It's no bad thing. Something also I've witnessed seems to be part of your new mindset and how you like to connect with life is wild water swimming.
It's true.
I love it.
I was introduced into sea swimming years ago when I was still drinking, and I very nearly got in. My friend of mine goes in nearly every day, and he was like, I actually didn't believe that he did it because it was like December or January. And he was like, yeah, I'll go in all the time. He's like, let's just go in tomorrow. And I met him. I was outside my house by 8 a.m. and I was like, no.
No,
that's mental. And then into sobriety, there's so much time on your hands. And I was like, I'm gonna chase him up on this one. I'm gonna go in. The first time I went into the water, it was, I think it was February, which is probably the coldest it really gets. And I lost my voice. It was just so, it's like the devil comes out of you, And I've got this other theory as well that when you do things like that, you can like scream and you can be like, oh my God. And you can just express yourself in this way that you can't do in Sainsbury's.
Yeah, you get it out.
Yeah, and it's the same as being on a stage. I used to get lost on, is that me? Am I acting? Or who is that person on stage? And I now realise, no, that is me. That's just a side of me that requires that context in order for it to make sense,
You know what's a massive shame is that it's not seen as a sort of everyday thing that we have access to, because unless you're in a rock band or you live near very cold water, when can we do that? I mean, I see my kids do it. They'll run around outside of the school going absolutely crazy, screaming, shouting, but it's so not the done thing for an adult. And like you, I love swimming in the sea. I went about a month ago, a few weeks ago now, and it was fucking freezing, but it was so incredible. And me and my mate were quite literally like bellowing the cove into silence. We were like screeching, but it felt so amazing. And I guess one of the problems we all have is we all get, say we have felt anger because someone said something to us, say we have felt sorrow because of whatever, any of those really strong emotions, we don't often have the space to exorcise them, get them out, let them be free. We trap it all inside and we'll be like so angry, but it's all inside. And something like the stage or the sea, or I'm trying to think of any other examples. Maybe boxing is a good one. Running.
It's like sports. I think when you go, like football, but I imagine when you go, when you go watch football, that suddenly it's like, oh, now we can be nutters. Now we can scream.
We need more of that. Mental.
Now men can hug each other.
Yeah, exactly. But I think we need to sort of cultivate more opportunities in everyday life where we can, scream in the street if we need to. Not, in a distressing way, but, let it all out. Or, I will often, from running, I will, sprint rather than jog at points to, I've got to get something out of me. But it's not the dumb thing. It's a shame.
Yeah, on that sober tour, I was doing some of the craziest shit on stage I've ever done.
Like what?
I started off by, there's loads of feedback going, I was just sort of doing karate kicks into the amps.
Yeah.
And acting like the amps were trying to fight me. And this is just purely for my own entertainment. And then Ben was looking at me like, what's he doing? And then I just took the bass off and I just, as hard as I could, just threw the whole thing into the amps and then I just pushed all of the amps over.
Wow.
And it felt amazing. And it's, I was like, I can't do that anywhere else.
Nope.
that's not okay.
No.
In normal life. But I was like, on stage, I was like, this is designed for me to do things like that.
We need more stuff like that. I feel like, you know, kids have so many opportunities. Like, you know, if I take my kids to a ball pit, Oh, they're jumping, they're throwing stuff, they're pushing, you know, like bouncing off the walls. Like, you have that, you know, like, just freedom, isn't it? It's liberation. There's no containment of anything. And I feel like we're really missing out on that in life. Big time.
Yeah, I want to go to one of those rooms where you can just smash plates. Have you heard of them?
Yeah, we need to do that. Plate smashing, you know. Anything that feels a bit out of the ordinary and I'm imagining like you karate chopping an amp, just very natural for that to just like weirdly unfurl.
Yeah.
Like the only other time I can really think that I had that huge release was giving birth to my kids, where I just did not care. I was like howling and making these amazing noises and, you know, just proper freedom. But in everyday life, that's not the done thing. So you've given me a mission. I'm going to look for more opportunities to do that in life. I think it's a sensible idea.
Especially to scream.
Screaming's so good.
It's amazing. Like, it's difficult to even like now, I'm like, where would I go? And the only place is probably the sea. Even then, I'll be a bit like, have to be at 6 a.m, make sure there's no one around. Yeah.
But it's also a bit embarrassing. And also, I think the first time you hear yourself scream, you feel embarrassed even like for yourself when it's just you on your own. Like, this is really cringy, but I think we need that release.
We do. Yeah, the sea definitely did that. It's the one. Who knew going in freezing cold water was so good for you?
It's the best. We've had Wim Hof on this very podcast and...
Incredible.
You know, hearing him talk about it, you're like, why am I not doing... I mean, I don't live by the sea, unfortunately. I'd love to one day, but for the moment, it's freezing showers, which... you know, isn't quite as atmospheric, but, and I definitely can't scream because my neighbours would probably call the police, but it's, you get that sensation, it's extreme and it's needed and, you know, it's, we've got to do it.
Did he say that, am I making this up, did he say that he found a sense of control when he was in there? Because that makes sense to me. It's, I think the same with the screaming thing and the expressing yourself, it's like, suddenly you're in control again.
Yeah.
And you're the one that's deciding to go in there. You know, you're inflicting it on yourself. And it's a sense of control that's... And with a side product of it being really, really good for your mental health and your physical health. But that's something I've thought about. When you go in, you're like, yeah, there's finally some control over something, you know?
Yeah.
There's very little we sort of can control. Very little. it's like this much we can actually have control over.
I know. Amazing. So look, it's sea swimming, it's karate chopping amps, it's not going to bars, it's having that gratitude you just talked about. It's an amazing thing, and I'm so thrilled for you. I'm so glad that you're carrying on with doing what you do, making magical music but without booze. It's a beautiful thing, and thank you for making such an amazing album, which has brought me a lot of joy over the last week. So thank you so much, and I'm so glad we got to talk today.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I can tell you one thing. Mike continues to make absolutely astounding music with his mate Ben. You probably already guessed from that chat, but I'm completely obsessed with playing Royal Blood's new album, Typhoons. It is just bringing me so much joy listening to that album. And my kids love it. My husband loves it. It's just the most brilliant album. And also, it's really good for running if you are also a keen runner. And huge news, they're going to be back out on tour in 2022 playing the big arenas, including London's O2. I have to go, I've got to be there. If all that chat about immersing ourselves in freezing cold water intrigued you, do go back and listen to that episode with Wim Hof. Oh, he's such a legend. And you can get into cold showers by listening to that. And you can always let me know how you get on with it by saying hello on Instagram. We are at Happy Place Official. Love hearing from you there. Thanks again to the brilliant Mike, to the producer Anushka Tate at Rethink Audio, and to you lot for listening. You are the best, simply the best. I'm off to find somewhere to let out a beautiful scream. I'll see you next week.